It's a sled. He's dead. The box contains his wife's head. Vadis, his father, they're allergic to water. She's his sister and her daughter.
You watched it from
Wacky Races.
Hi there, everybody. Have you missed us? This is Wade.
This is Siggy, and you're listening to You Watched It Wrong, the podcast where we are in our fourth installment of our Wacky Races. It's a mini series where this episode we're talking about
1969's film, Those Daring Young Men in Their Jaunty Jalopies, or also known as Monte Carlo or Bust. It goes by both titles, depending on where you buy, rent, or rent it. Siggy and I have been referring to it exclusively as one or the other and never really discussing why we are calling it the same thing.
Well, it was released in Britain as Monte Carlo or Bust, was released, retitled for the American release to Those Daring Young Men and Their Jaunty Jalopies. Given that it is principally a British, French, and Italian co-production, I think going with the Monte Carlo or Bust is maybe more canonical, even though I prefer Those Daring Young Men and Their Jaunty Jalopies because it ties it to its predecessor, which is, I think, the whole marketing strategy.
Exactly. It's got the same framework as its spiritual, if not direct, sequel, Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines. I prefer that one as well. It's got a nice ring to it. It's kind of a jaunty title.
It is. Yeah. I think it's a spirited. It's a spirited dash of a title. It's also really long, and these movies we've been doing have been a bit on the long side, although this one is reversing that a little bit, but we'll talk about that, I think.
Those Magnificent Men had the subtitle, if not just even longer title of, or How I Flew to Paris, London to Paris in 25 hours, 11 minutes.
Yeah, I'm glad we dispensed with that here.
But if Jaunty Jalopies did have that extended thing, what would it be? If it was Those Daring Young Men and Their Jaunty Jalopies, or
Ran five races simultaneously and then turned it into one race and then decided to tack on a speed trial at the end for no discernible reason.
Good. I love it.
But before we jump into all of that and how maybe that makes sense or even has historic precedent, first, I wanted to rewind a little bit because we've been talking about since the first episode of this miniseries, and we covered It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, how the predecessor to even that first primordial Wacky Race movie, well, that was really the first ordeal Wacky Race movie because the primordial one was Around the World in 80 Days. And that was kind of cited as the big epic travelogue movie with the huge ensemble cast. That was a big hit, won Best Oscar, and was...
Best Oscar? Wow. Of all the Oscars, it won Best Oscar?
It won the Best Oscar, the biggest, best one.
That's amazing.
For Best Picture. And how that was, like, trying to reproduce that magic was what led to, in part, to It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And so I finally got around to watching that 1956 David Niven starrer. And I'm really glad I did, because I feel like I really should have watched it before we started this series. It has a lot in common with the movies that we've been talking about. You know, especially these last three, Magnificent Men, The Great Race, and Monte Carlo or Bust, if you will, they really have a lot more DNA in common with Around the World in 80 Days than they do with the Mad World. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's things that they all have in common. You know, they all have the big budget. They all have lots of location shooting. Well, Mad World doesn't have lots of location shooting. It's pretty confined to Southern California. But all these other ones are, you know, like part of the appeal is a multinational location, lots of location shooting.
The travelogue, the globe hopping travelogue.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They both have the enormous cast. If we were to count Around the World in 80 Days, then right now we would have these additions to our two-timer club. this is asterisk, unofficial, but we would have, we would add Robert Morley, Red Skelton, Buster Keaton, Joey Brown, and Andy Devine. All make appearances in Around the World in 80 Days. It's also got cameos.
Should they be retroactively added into evidence?
They've got the cameos that are just serve no other purpose than a cameo. There's a Frank Sinatra cameo that's very much like the Three Stooges, where it's just like he turns around and he looks at the camera and that's it. Like, oh, that was the back of his head.
There he is, folks.
That's Frank Sinatra. I recognize him.
You can't sue us. He's in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's got the same kind of retro framing device for the introduction, like Great Race and Magnificent Men does, where it starts with a reduced aspect ratio, in fact, reduced frame. And Edward R. Murrow, like in a newsreel, introduces like the concept of H.G. Wells' stories and their place in history of the cinema, and he shows you clips from Méliès, which is based on a trip to the moon, the H.G. Wells story, and like you watch a good deal of this Méliès movie, and then it goes from that to a rocket ship, and he's like a camera aboard a rocket orbiting the Earth. And it's like, this is, now that we're entering the rocket age, where someday we will go to the moon. It's funny to hear that. It's 1956. But, you know, it's like very much doing the same Magnificent Men thing of like transitioning from the past to the rocket age, but it's doing an introduction instead of in the coda to the movie. It's got the similar kind of structure where we have the scene where somebody has to propose the race before it can start. Like it has to be a fresh idea in someone's mind, and then people will scramble for the resources to do it. It's got what you were talking about, the side quests where, oh, I'm stuck on my journey, so now I got to go. Said get the key from the horse, but it's got that kind of thing. but, you know, it's also like this really square movie that's got this the sense of grandiosity and nostalgia for the wonders of a past age when we were trying to achieve better things, but it's really really pretty square, as opposed to like all these other movies we've been doing are pretty square movies, but that's starting to turn here now with Jaunty Jalopies, where it's trying to be, even though it's still a period piece, it's trying to be more hip in a very conscious way.
They're trying to be funny for a change.
If we're talking about, surprised to hear you diss Mad World like that. I mean, I didn't mean to change your mind on that way. But
I was thinking primarily of its sequel, its predecessor.
Well, I'm talking about all the movies in this whole series so far, and this is really. We're really trying to be more of a youth culture kind of thing here, at least with the pacing of it. Like, it's just very, hyperactive, short attention span movie compared to the other ones we've done.
Directed by our buddy, our friend and yours, Ken Anakin. But you know what? Okay, so let me just say, like, I saw this pretty soon after watching those Magnificent Men. So it's been a while for me. I'm going to be a little behind on this one. But I got good notes, dear listener. I would not short shrift you. I'm not coming unprepared. But I will say that within 3 minutes and 39 seconds of this movie, I'm going, troublesome stereotypes aside, this movie is way funnier than the entirety of those Magnificent Men already. Just those 3 minutes.
Oh my God, the first 3 minutes, the worst 3 minutes of the movie?
Yeah, the worst 3 minutes of the movie. Still way funnier.
The opening was pretty despicable, but it's
very despicable. The beginning is very despicable. But I can say what was capturing my attention more so than the, as Disney refers to them, outdated depictions and not straight up racism. What was I trying to say? Yeah, but the weird thing is that sequence, which was so weird to me, I was looking at the pretty offensive, goofy stereotypes they have of the Indian people that the British are occupying. But the use of the camera has completely changed. The cinematography is a 100-degree like whip around from previously. They're doing camera moves that accentuate what's going on in the frame. The camera is defter and lighter, and it's moving with there's the scene where the gunmen are taking shots at the guy riding through the alley, and it's like moving in a way that Magnificent Men would never do. And I'm like, what happened to Ken Anakin in these last like 4 years?
It feels modernized.
It really does.
Like he's like been watching the Monkees or something. Like he's he's got a little more caffeine in his beverage.
Yeah. The formalism is gone. And now this movie feels a lot more down and dirty than the previous one. And it's the same directors. I'm like, it's hard for me to figure it out. to square, you know, that it's the same guy. Plus, the one thing that I was impressed by outside of Terry Thomas and its agenda to like promote women's liberation in the time period is that all the nationalities that they had in the movie were cast with people who really were of those nationalities.
Just like,
I was like, really?
Just like in Magnificent Men, yeah.
Oh, well, I was talking about Magnificent Men.
Right.
But in this one, you know, there's some liberties taken. The Italians play Italians and Germans play Germans, but I mean, like that opening sequence, you're like, ooh, oh no.
Oh yeah. Right. Some brown they face have there.
They have people in brown face, and it's like, you know what? To Magnificent Men's credit, they never did that.
No, because there were no non-white people depicted except for the Japanese pilot.
The Japanese pilot, yeah.
Well, I got to say, I had never heard of this movie. I had never heard of those Magnificent Men and their flying machines, except that it was recommended to us in a Facebook post by a friend of mine from Britain. But he didn't even mention this one. So it was in learning more about those Magnificent Men that we found, oh, there's a sequel. We should check that one out too. And the information on this movie is a lot more scarce than the others. So I was trying to get the numbers, and they're not real firm. So we got a loose number of a $10,000 budget. Just saying that Paramount Pictures contributed to, or $10 million to the budget.
Say, that's 10, incredible.
They bought lunch for the cast and crew for a week. No, $10 million budget by Paramount out of how much? I don't know, but that's still more than Magnificent Men, which was like $5.6 million for the time. Mm-hmm. So given that, you know, we're talking about like in today's dollars, that's something like a $50 million movie. but still, almost, you know, a considerable increase over its predecessor. Again, 4 years passing since those Magnificent Men, same production team, a lot of the same cast, have no idea how well this movie did. So I'm assuming it didn't do well at all. I couldn't find any box office numbers on it whatsoever that made any sense. So,
well, it's not highly available and hasn't been for a while. So like, and that might tell you something right there.
There wasn't even a DVD issue until like 2006, something like that. So, this one fell into obscurity pretty quickly, at least in the States. But I guess they issue DVDs in England, too. So maybe it didn't do so hot over there either. Maybe it wasn't quite hip enough despite its attempts.
Now, some notable crew changes between the two. Just looking at the feel of the film alone, you can tell the Magnificent Men had Daryl Zanuck as one of the four producers, which included the director and co-screenwriter. But Daryl Zanuck was traded out in this one for Dino De Laurentiis. So that's kind of a remarkable shift in tone associated with both producers.
Yeah, a little more purient this time around. A little more a little more TNA happening.
Yeah.
A little less modest.
Now, the cinematographers are different. The Magnificent Men cinematographer did like A Shock in the Dark and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Force 10 from Navarone on Evil Under the Sun and Top Secret, as I mentioned. Now, this one, Gabor I don't know how to pronounce his name, Gabor Pagani, maybe? He did mostly Italian films, and then this was his one, like, well, one of the non-Italian films he did. But he did also shoot a movie also called Top Secret. Not that one, but just thought it was a little neat thing. Now, the editors, remember I went on about how the editor of Magnificent Men was Anne V. Coates, who did Lawrence of Arabia and Beckett and Elephant Man and Murder on the Orient Express and Out of Sight and Aaron Brockovich and 50 Shades of Grey.
But she took Magnificent Men off.
Right. But
mailed that
she
one
didn't
in.
Come back for this one. Instead, Peter Taylor did. So is it a step down? He is an Oscar winner for editing Bridge Over the River Kwai. He did The Third Man and Summertime and Taming of the Shrew and Hobson's Choice. So you also got maybe not as much of a pedigree, but you guys still got a high pedigree editor here. You know, so while the cinematographer is a lot different in what it's trying to achieve in this one, the camera work, the editing, they all seem to get they were doing a comedy. And even if that comedy wasn't great at times, they were attempting comedy. Which is, again, I can't stress this enough, the first one didn't do.
You know, we talked about the, we quoted the review of Magnificent Men right. That said it moves, and we, like, couldn't believe, like, it's the one thing that movie doesn't do, but this movie does. Like,
this movie moves.
This movie hits you, even when it's not being funny, like, it's going so fast, it still, like, kept a smile on my face the whole way through. Once we got past those first despicable 3 minutes.
Yeah, the trouble parts for me were the representations of Indian citizens in the beginning, and then the Italian segments of I want big breasts. That was really hard for me to get through. But the good thing is, like we said, this movie rolls by so fast that they go right past those lead balloons. We don't know they're lead balloons.
Yeah.
They'll just, it's okay. That's not sitting in my lap, holding me down. It was way back there in the dust. So, it was this movie certainly moves, and it's better for it.
Well, let's talk about the cast real quick. These are big ensemble movies. We like to talk about the cast. This one's a weird one. It's credited in a very strange way in that they just dump a bunch of the cast on the screen and then discredit them in alphabetical order, but they're mixing like main cast and obvious supporting cast that are only in like two scenes. And so it's hard to say who, like if you're talking about like the depth of the cast, it's hard to know where to start, but I'm just going to start with who's in our recurring cast members from earlier in our miniseries. Most of these overlapping with Magnificent Men we have, but not so would be Tony Curtis, straight off of The Great Race, jumping right into another wacky race. He's in our two-timer club along with Gert Fröbe. I'm studying a little bit of German and I'm having trouble with the umlauts, but I think it'd be Ib, Fröbe.
Fröbe.
Okay. Eric Sykes, who's our Percy. Spencer? No, what's the butler's name, the assistant?
He is Percy.
Perkins.
Right.
Sir Percy was the villain, Magnificent Men, played by, lapping the field, our first member of the three-timer club, Terry Thomas.
And then we
had a couple of asterisks who are really in cameos, unrecognizable cameos. They don't even register as cameos to me in either movie, but Willie Rushton and Michael Trubshaw are in. They reprise their cameo status from Magnificent Men. They're in both of them. So they're technically in the two-timer club as well. But Terry Thomas, man. Mm. I think this is my favorite of the Terry Thomas performances we've seen so far.
Yeah, he's really good in this.
I think he's great.
In Magnificent Men, he is good and the story does not service him. In this one, the story services him and he's good.
Yeah, so I feel like I really get Terry Thomas now. I'm like, oh yeah, I would just watch a Terry Thomas picture. Like if this is his wheelhouse, like this is just kind of the guy he plays.
Right,
this is his stock and trade. Like, yeah, I'll go for that.
So this takes place in what's the year it takes place? I didn't write it down.
It didn't say. It's in the Jazz Age. Tony Curtis's character Chester is being very jazzy. He's doing a Harold Lloyd thing, like, which is we're in
always holding the glasses up, without putting them on.
His whole bit, his whole shtick is like he's kind of doing a Harry Lloyd, like just a go getter. You know, he's speedy basically in this movie.
One of my favorite, if the thing that I will always remember about this movie is a Tony Curtis moment. Actually, I love the scene where Tony Curtis learns his co-driver has fallen ill, and he won't be able to race. And he does it. He gets out of the phone booth, and Terry Thomas opens his door to say, "Hello, what's the matter?" And Tony Curtis just comes right up and sits in his lap.
Yeah.
And Thomas's expression is not big, but it's so subtle with his, like, "What? What?" And then he said, like, he's so overwhelmed by the impropriety of it that when he says, "My co-driver just came down with," and then he whispers into his ear what he came down with, and Terry Thomas is like, "Oh, please, I just had breakfast."
They do have good chemistry together.
They really do.
I think this is the most I've enjoyed Tony Curtis in a movie, too. And
I had a feeling like it you were going to say that.
I think the best made comedy of all time, and I think Tony Curtis is really good in that. And I usually don't like Tony Curtis. I think this is the most fun I've ever had watching Tony Curtis.
Yeah.
I think he's pretty.
He's a lot of fun.
I think he's pretty great. Apparently, not a lot of fun to work with. So one of the few bits of information we have from our extensive reading of the Wikipedia page is that Tony Curtis was a pain in the ass. But at least Ken Anakin didn't like working with him. But
on screen, he does. Here, he's playing a bit of a goofball, and I think the goofball element works for him.
Yeah, and doing his Brooklyn accent. He's not doing his Archie Leach, his Cary Grant impression.
That was his
impression he's doing for the bit in Some Like It Hot when he's trying to seduce Marilyn Monroe, and then he just kept doing it for like a lot of his career. But he's going back to his New York accent here, and I think he's a lot funnier when he does that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, Terry Thomas is interesting. He is not reprising his previous character, Sir Percy Ware Cuthbert.
Cuthbert is his first name in this one. No, Ware Armitage.
Armitage.
If you had
he's not reprising
apparently
his
used
role.
Toilets and urinals in the U.K., then you would recognize this as a manufacturer of such.
Oh, so Ware Armitage is a manufacturer of toilets in the UK?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That'd be like
That's
Otis.
A great...
When the Otis says elevators. What's the...
Standard. We'd be American Standard.
There
you
go.
It's not really that. That's or Kohler, but they do all sorts of stuff. That's a great joke. Okay, you know what? I take that back. First movie. That was a good joke. But so he's not reprising his role as Sir Percy Ware Armitage. Rather, he's reprising his role. He's not reprising. He's playing the role of Sir Percy's son, Cuthbert Ware Armitage, who apparently takes no genes from his mother.
Yes. Chip off the old block, I'd say.
But I love his introduction in this movie because, the first movie, this movie quickly establishes how much people hate him.
And that he cheats at lawn sports.
Right. I just love that guy walking up and saying, is Sir Cuthbert around? I actually have bad news for Sir Cuthbert Ware Armitage. And one of the other golfers is like, good. It's like, you did that very well. Yeah. And so then the thing sets up where basically Sir Ware, and they mentioned Sir Percy because
the bad news is that
Sir Percy has perished. He's passed away.
In a flying machine.
Yeah, he says probably on one of his old flying machines, eh?
Yeah.
And they say yes. And Sir Cuthbert is nonplussed, if not happy about this, because that means he has now inherited Ware Armitage Industries, right?
Yeah, or whatever. And the title.
And the title.
He's assumed the lordship. This whole scene plays really great.
It does, really good.
And this is like maybe the one straight performance in the whole movie is the guy who delivers the news to him and is shocked by his reaction.
Right.
And he plays it so great. This whole scene is really wonderful.
Again, Ken Anakin must have watched Terry Thomas in that first movie and thought, oh, we can be funny? Let's do that. This is a recurring thing. I'm going to come back to time and time again. Okay, maybe I'll put a moratorium on that. Okay. Point made. Moving on.
I've lost track of where we are in the episode. Okay. Well, before we start going scene by scene, so dear listener, I want to apologize. I think Wade was nice and he said it wasn't so, but I think he's just being nice. I think I ruined last episode by taking a scene by scene, which I hadn't even planned on doing. It just kind of happened and then I couldn't stop myself. It just got pulled in.
It's still fun.
I just want to talk about how that first 20 minutes was like this a series of cartoons. And then you go into the big announcement, conception, pitching of the race, which is like a big stock scene in these movies now, which this movie doesn't do.
Yes.
We have our first big innovation in the series is every other installment in some form had the scene where, let me tell you what the race is. I have an idea for a race. I might be dying and I'm going to tell you where money's buried. Or I might just have a challenge that I can make this trip around the world in 80 days. Or, gentlemen, I think we should promote the industry of X with some kind of sponsored international competition. We dispense with that. That's just assumed. You know that when
it's
you see the poster
happening
in the lobby. And so we're going to get past that, and we're just going to start with people already being excited about the race.
There's going to be a race.
Yes.
In fact, the only setup they do is in that scene where they establish a wager set up between Ware Armitage and Tony Curtis.
Well, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to run through the plot, but we're going to, for the most part...
You run through the plot. I'll be quiet.
This movie's going to cut to the race. It's not going to cut to the chase because a chase is not a race. That's how you either get into this miniseries or you don't if it's a chase movie. That's why Smokey and the Bandit isn't part of a wacky race movie. It's a wacky chase movie.
That's a chase movie.
It's different.
Totally different.
In a chase, the two parties have different goals. In a race, they have the same goal.
Ruh and cha makes all the difference.
Even if they're going to the same place, they've got one's running, one's chasing. That's different. Okay. So, plot structure. Now, Magnificent Men, I ran through the elements of the plot that actually had consequences for anything that followed. And it was very few plot elements that actually mattered. Because almost everything
in the time that you went through the whole thing.
Yeah. Almost everything had no relevance to anything whatsoever beyond its own scene. Now there's a lot of that in this movie too. There's a lot of like little conflicts that get resolved within their scene and then have no consequence. So that we're not completely devoid of that, but we have a little more, I'd say a lot more, plotting, in this one. So I'm just going to run through it real quick. Just give you an outline in case you haven't seen the movie and you don't plan to, because you don't want to pay $2.99 to rent it online. Okay.
Which in this case, I would say, apart from the overt racism of some moments, I would say rent this one.
I would say rent this one too. Just get your dose of salt ready. But when you get past, I would say there was two scenes that bothered me and we'll get to that. Okay.
We'll get to that.
Okay. Plot structure. Introduction. What don't we have? We don't have a retro framing device.
No retro framing device.
No old-timey film, no slides, no anything. We're just starting with a movie. And the movie is this awful, execrable action in India where these childish simpletons are throwing away their own lives to deliver this very important letter to the Memsahib who... you know, they either are speaking gibberish or they're speaking childish English to each other and giving the password of curry powder. It's really awful. Anyway, we get past that. We've got some gags. I'm not going to get into it. They deliver the letter to Major Dawlish and what I don't have is...
Lieutenant Armitage, I think.
Lieutenant, thank you. Lieutenant, right?
Lieutenant.
So, Major and Lieutenant, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore. The only other members of the cast mentioned that I, whose names I would recognize or have seen anything, although...
Who could be reading the phone book and I would be entertained. These guys are amazing.
I was not very familiar with them as a team. I've read about them. They're legendary. I've always meant to check them out, and I never really have. So outside of the wedding scene in The Princess Bride, I don't know if I've ever seen Peter Cook in anything besides
this. I recommend seeing Bedazzled. That's Bedazzled is a movie that I don't know if I can accurately vet it, because it was one of those movies I saw when I was really young, and my dad loved it, so we loved it. You know what I mean? So, like, it's imprinted on me. But I really, really enjoy Bedazzled, and seeing those two work together. Peter Cook's the devil, and Dudley Moore is someone who's selling his soul to him. And their chemistry is just, it's awesome.
Well, it's on my watch list. Someday I hope to get to it. Okay. But now we're running through the plot. So, introduction, these two British Indian officers get the letter. They have been preparing to enter this race to preserve the empire for their emperor king. And they've made a bunch of inventions that they show off. Okay. So they're ready. They're already chomping at the bit. Now, introduction to the teams. Okay. We're going to go around to all the other teams. We're going to establish their motivations. So we meet Cuthbert, and his motivation is... he wants to win the other half of his factory, his father's factory, because it is now in the possession of Chester Schofield, played by Tony Curtis. And so they make a bet. They don't like each other. Chester's this free-willing guy. They make a bet. Whoever wins the race or beats the other one in the race gets full possession of the car factory, of Daddy's car factory. Okay. Rivalry established. Rivalries are important in this genre.
Yeah,
going forward,
much.
It hasn't really been so much going backwards. I mean, you know, I guess you can argue that. Okay, we meet a couple Italian policemen. They won a contest. One of them just wants to use the money to get girls. The other one wants to be the most famous race car driver in the world. So he... without consulting his brother, are they brothers? I think they're brothers.
I think so.
Bought a car to enter the race, the Monte Carlo race, even though neither of them can drive. Wait, I shouldn't have mentioned that fact. It doesn't matter.
Somehow they take off in the car.
You would think buying a car before they know how to drive and they're going to enter a race would somehow have consequence for the plot of the movie. It does not.
Right.
It matters not a whit. Don't even mention it again. Okay. But that's their deal. One of them wants to get girls. The other one wants to get be the most famous race in the world. Not just any girl. He wants a girl with nice big boobs. That's important.
A part that was overly belabored that was embarrassing.
It's, you know, it's a broad comedy at this point.
Literally, right.
And it's okay to like big boobs. He's a big boob man. He can't lie. You know? No. You other brothers can't deny. We meet... this is the other part of the movie that pissed me off. We meet a carload of ladies in France who are too busy gossiping and chattering away to pay attention to where they're driving and are zigzagging all over the road.
Yeah. Undercranked and their voices elevated to...
yeah, they have chipmunk voices because it's just, you know, they're not talking about anything important. They're just gabbing. They're just gabbing ladies. And they run off the road, crash into the director of the race, I guess, of the entire race, played by Bourville. A guy, I guess he's a French comedian. I've never heard of him. That doesn't mean he's not great in other movies. I find him annoying as shit in this scene.
Yeah.
Anyway, he doesn't want to let her in.
Yet first billed in the movie.
Well, I think it's the alphabetical thing.
But he is a big deal.
He's in two scenes.
Right.
Maybe three. So we're back at his office. He's still in pain. He's got his gross bare foot sticking out on his couch. And the doctor comes in, and who is it but... the very same lady who crashed into him. She is a doctor, even though she's dressed as a pretty lady. She's a doctor. And she takes his pants off and does some chiropractic and pops him back into shape. and now she's in the race, even though he didn't want to let her in.
Now, I grew to like this actress quite a bit throughout the movie.
Yes.
Just every now and again, like that scene seemed to be somewhat reminiscent of Natalie Wood's scene in Great Race, right?
Yeah.
Her coming in, with asserting her professionalism and her sexuality and all that.
But then she even says she's a liberated woman, and that's why she can take off his pants.
Right. I think she does. But there's something in the tone of the movie that I don't, unlike Blake Edwards, I'm not so sure the director believes it. You know, I mean, like Blake Edwards has got this on the mind. He's got an agenda. He's got something to put, you know, he feels strongly about this. I'm not so sure Ken does. I think he's got kind of a,
he's a little bit of a poser. I
yeah,
think,
exactly.
Maybe. Yeah.
It's the trendy thing to do. I'm sorry, but we're doing the rundown.
That's Mirelle Dark.
Right. And she plays Marie Claude, I believe.
Yes. Dr. Marie Claude. Do you?
I mean, I do enjoy the fact that she's, you know, a professional doctor who's done all this stuff and a race car driver, but she's also decidedly feminine. I like that. But yeah, the way that they're introduced with the bad driving, running around, crashing into things, chattering like chipmunks, that is like, so you're not, you don't, but you're not buying what you're selling, in other way.
Yeah.
You don't believe what you're selling.
It's troubling.
It's really distasteful. Yeah.
Yeah. That won't really present itself much later, where they're going to turn out to be a very competent racing team. They're going to give
right.
The Italians all they can handle. But we're going to get to that. We also introduce, we see getting sprung from prison, Willie Schickel, played by Gert Fröbe again, and Otto Schwartz, played by Pierre Schmidt. They're broken out of prison. We don't know. This all looks pre-arranged. They know what to do. We don't know how this got arranged. But they break out. They get taken to some castle where the evil Count Levinovich, played by a not Russian, Jack Hawkins, real Russian name, Jack Hawkins, is going to explain. There's some very plotty business here where there was another driver already entered into the race, but he's at the bottom of a lake because he refused to take part in the smuggling scheme.
Right.
So this evil count broke out Willie, who not only is a perfect ringer, a dead ringer for the dead driver, in another twin plot.
Right. Like Great Race.
Yeah. But he's also the best driver of the criminal underworld of Germany. Nice, nifty coincidence there. but none of that matters. All that matters is he's going to be given a spare tire. One out of five spare tires is going to have something smuggled in it. He just has to get it to Monte Carlo and not be conspicuous. Don't get photographed. Wear this mustache and finish 26th. Just don't finish
and
first.
And he doesn't know which tire it is.
No, he's told. It's fourth from the bottom.
Oh, that's right.
He's going to screw that up when he mixes up the tires, right. And so he'll lose right. track of which one's fourth. But that will come later. Okay. And then we've already introduced the British Indio teams. They don't get introduced here. So here's our cast of characters. They've right. all got a motivation. We see them acquire the means, basically, to get into the race at this point. That's going to be a formulaic plot that we haven't always gotten in the past. Okay. Race begins.
Might I say, a nice 32 minutes into the movie, the race begins?
Yeah.
Quite an improvement over 90 boom, minutes. Boom.
Each team gets one, maybe two scenes to set them up. We're on to the next team. Now we're going to start the race. We're going to have the rules clearly explained. We get an animated sequence to explain these really convoluted rules to this race. But this is how they really did it. This is actually based on the real Monte Carlo rally, which is...
Really?
Yeah. Started in 1911, something like that. And has been running for every year, not without some controversy. And we might have occasion to talk about that in a bit. But as rules are explained, they're going to start in five separate locations throughout Europe. They all converge in Switzerland. Then they have a final race from Switzerland down to Monte Carlo. And the allegedly the first one to Monte Carlo will be the winner. That's how it's explained to us. So we go to each of our five starting locations. That's not true. We're going to go to three of our five starting locations.
Right, right.
Where
John O'Coat, Goats, Stockholm, and Ragusa.
Yes. We're not going to go to Greece or Spain.
Why would we?
No, no. Even though we... well, never mind. So at each of these three starting locations, two of our teams are going to get paired up, and we're going to have rivalries. Now, one of our rivalries mm-hmm. is already established. That's Sir Cuddy and Chester.
Right.
They're up in Scotland. But then we're going to pair up the Italians, who are lusty for love, with the all-female car. That makes a lot of sense. By the way, this is our second movie now with the all-female car. The Great Race had a one female car, but she was the only mm-hmm. occupant. But now the all-female car, I think, is going to be a recurring.
The Lady Doctor car.
Yeah. Yes. Yep. Yep. The girl car. And then...
Whose names are Marie, Claude, Dominique, and Pascal, just so we know.
Yeah. Thank you.
They have names.
Yes. Two of them don't really have... personalities
parts or characters,
or
right?
Dialogue, but
exactly.
They're there, and then the Brits are up against the Germans, the Imperial Brits, the Brits who care about empire, the Brits with honor,
right?
We'll say are up against the Germans. Okay, so now we're off.
Who are criminals in this one?
They're criminals
in this one. I said,
yeah. Maybe it's worth pausing here just to note
yeah.
that once again, each of our teams is representing some kind of broad national stereotype, although it's a little bit fuzzier this time around, but they're different stereotypes.
Right.
Okay. So Sir Cuddy's still Sir.
Right.
He's still Sir Percy. He's just a bounder. Right.
Tony Curtis is a different American
the stereotype. Unworthy aristocracy. The unworthy landed
unworthy.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Just inheriting titles that he would never have earned.
Right.
But then we have the American, instead of this time of being a cowboy, he's a jazz age free spirit.
Right.
Right. The other Brits, instead of being the stuck up, sexless, mirthless, but kind of, you know, heroic figure, are these pompous buffoons who are like caricatures of empire.
Colonialism,
so,
right.
So Magnificent Men was like celebrating and nostalgic for empire. Here we're lampooning empire.
Totally.
Right?
Totally.
The British Empire. The Germans, like, instead of being the, by the book, doctrinaire, rigid types, they're what, pugnacious and short-tempered? I don't know. It doesn't really, I don't really understand. Right. They hold their poo in with their hand when they have to go. I don't know what the what the stereotype is exactly here. And then the French girls, they're sexy French girls, I guess.
Right.
I don't know. And then the Italians are hot-blooded, working-class dreamers who can't resist their Lothario urges. Lothario
right.
urges. Instead of the Catholic devoted family man of the original, of the
Who doesn't factor into the plot.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead it's, you know, before it was the Frenchman's turn to be the ladies' man, the tail chaser, now it's the Italian's turn. Yay, we're expanding our boundaries. Okay.
They're proving once again we are not a monolith.
All right. Back to the plot, okay? Something very plotty happens as the race yep. starts. As you said, Chester's racing partner is dropped out because mm-hmm. Sir Cuddy drugged him. And the rules say you can't have another race, so Chester's just got to go it alone. So stage one begins. A bunch of business happens. Almost none of it has any consequence.
No.
Here's what has consequence.
I barely remember it.
Yeah. Chester picks up someone by the side of the road. This is Betty, played by Susan right. Hampshire. She's a lady, a lady's lady. She ends up going along for the ride, but she keeps slowing him down. She wants to stop and go shopping and stuff. So he's got to deal with that.
The pretense is that she has lost her horse and she's looking for her horse,
and
right?
He can't go.
Is it clear from the beginning what her allegiance started with?
Cause no.
I kind of felt like it was kind of like you could assume, but you weren't sure.
If it was supposed to be signaled, I don't think it was signaled well.
It wasn't.
No, she wanted to go home, and her home was in the opposite direction. She didn't sign up for this race, and so she's not that interested in it. She wants to stop and go shopping, you know, like, and all kind of makes
sense.
But
she doesn't say, no, don't take me on this long race.
Yeah, she's attracted to him, I guess, and she has the means to get home because she's wealthy. I don't know. She carries her money on her, whatever.
Not wise when horse looking, but that's okay.
What else happens that is of consequence in this stage when we're running our separate races? Willie runs into some trouble at a border customs inspection because they are not supposed to be checking for customs. They're supposed to be lenient to participants in the race, but they're actually going to check. But he misdirects them over to Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. But none of that matters because they're going to... It's one of the weird things in this movie is, unlike The Great Race, where it kind of realistically, like, people get way ahead of each other and then they catch up and, like, they're kind of out of sync. In this one, everybody's is constantly racing neck and neck the entire way.
Right.
Every day of this race, even though they're, like, stopping and sleeping overnight, they, like, all end up sleeping in the same place at the same time.
In the same hotel.
Yeah. They all get there on the same day. None of this really matters very much. Okay. Willie decides he doesn't care about the race, and he's going to steal the gems. He figures these are gems in here. He finds them, but it turns out, no, this counts threats were real. He is being watched. If he tries to walk away with this car with the spare tire, he's going to get shot at, so he has to finish the race after all. That's about it. A bunch of other stuff happens that really... has no effect, such as Sir Cuddy does a little cheating, but none of it really slows anything down. Dawlish's inventions tend to backfire on him.
Yeah.
That's very humorous. The Italian guys and the French gal steal each other's clothes, which seems like that will be a plot point, but it is not. It doesn't matter. They're just wearing different clothes the rest of the movie. And that's it. Okay. They get rendezvous. They all meet at Switzerland. Okay, some stuff happens here. A bunch of shenanigans, a bunch of bed hopping.
Sexual assault that is then turned romantic for some really appalling reason.
Yeah. We can return to that. Well, it does matter because now Dr. Marie Claude and what's his name? Marcello. They actually are romantically linked for the rest of the movie after they hook up here.
After he grabs her and throws her in a room during a race, it just, that almost sunk the movie for me, really.
Yeah.
Because I was like,
but
I,
she liked it, it turns out. So it's okay.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. She liked it. That's the thing.
Those Italian men, they have a way. Those French girls, they, I guess they're into that. That's what we're led to believe in this movie. Don't try it at home, folks. Chester and Betty argue because he suspects that she has been trying to slow him down. Turns out he's right. He doesn't know that at this point.
This is the point where Cuthbert gives her the poison to give him, right?
Yeah. So he does get drugged. Chester gets drugged. This is going to matter because he's going to be very sleepy the rest of the movie. This is actually... something happens here that actually impacts someone's ability to participate in the race. He gets drugged and he can't stay awake. That's exciting. We should get more of that in these movies. Where somebody acquires additional challenges they have to overcome. Chester gets some of those. He gets two of those in this movie. He picks up a saboteur and he gets drugged.
And the fact is, then later, he's given some medicine to help him overcome the drug, but within a certain amount of time, he'll be twice as sleepy and won't be able to overcome
it. Well, that comes later. Sorry.
I'm jumping in.
So plots happen in sequence. It's generally how it works.
I don't understand this plotting you're talking
Terry
about.
Terry Thomas steals one of Willie's spare tires, or he has Perkins do it.
Right.
And guess which one he stole, folks? We all know which one it is. The one with the jewels in it. Okay. Because when Willie got shot at, he messed up
the order of the tires. He didn't know which one was which anymore. Okay, so now it's on Terry Thomas's car. Stage two of the race. Now they're all racing side by side down the road. What happens? Chester falls asleep. Betty tries to take over. She can't drive a stick. There's only sticks. Automatic transmission hasn't been invented yet. She's rich. She doesn't drive herself around. She rides a horse. So she drives over a waterfall. They get stuck on a precipice. There's a big rescue. This is what I like about these movies is when you have unexpected alliances. A bunch of the other, all of our other characters come to their rescue except for Terry Thomas. Even though Perkins wants to stop and help. Perkins is motivated to, but he never gets to the top of the precipice. But the rest all help him. And now they're in their race and they all get to Monte Carlo. And who wins? I don't remember who gets here first at this point. It doesn't matter. The race isn't over at this point. Because Bourville is going to say, no, we're going to have a time trial tomorrow. A speed trial. And that will determine who's actually going to win. This all seems very unmotivated. Like, I think what's missing here is a reason for this to happen. And I will say,
he got there.
This movie was a nice short 2 hours, 2 minutes, but I was watching the American cut, which is half an hour shorter than the international cut. Is that the one you watched too?
I watched the one on Apple, and I believe it was
That's the American cut.
Oh, okay. I didn't see the international cut.
Maybe this is explained more in the international edition. Okay. So they spend the night in Monte Carlo. We learn some things. Willie sees that the Count, the evil Count, the Russian Count, played by non-Russian Jack Hawkins, is arrested. So presumably he's free and clear. And he's going to decide at this point, even though he's not supposed to win the race, that he's going to go ahead and win the race. Doggone it. He's Willie.
Doesn't matter now.
Yeah. Okay. Also, Chester is going to be in his hotel room with Betty. Betty's going to confess everything to him. He's going to get down on one knee. And right in the middle of a sentence, we're going to cut to the next day. And I don't know if that's just an Apple iTunes movie fuck up or if that was just how the Americans edited it. They just said, nope, fuck the rest of that sentence and the rest of the scene. We're not going to actually watch the marriage proposal, which is presumably about to happen.
Right.
I don't know why, but it's the next day. And it seems really head-scratching. Maybe there's like full frontal nudity and oral sex happens next.
International version.
I don't know. Okay.
Before that, there was that great joke where they said, I'll keep you awake. How? I'll sing to you. Oh.
Okay. Time trial. Now we're in a big tense race around a mountain. Some things are going to happen here. Before we even start the race, Dawlish is going to start up a big engine on his car and it's going to explode. It's very funny. We've been building up to this moment because every single one of his inventions has exploded. So they're out. They're out of the race. Okay. As they're scrambling around, the spare tire with the jewels in it that Sir Cuddy stole is going to bounce off him and land on the Italian car. And the Italian saw where it came from. That's going to matter in a minute. Okay. All the racing causes another car wreck and a bunch of people are hurt. The French ladies stop. Dr. Marie Claude drops out of the race. Her duty as a doctor comes first. The other mm-hmm. ladies in the car are also trained medical professionals. So they're going to attend to the sick and injured. Well, the injured. And the Italians are so impressed that they're going to win for the ladies too. Okay. And Chester falls asleep at the wheel here on the mountain pass. So we get to the finish line and something really wonderful happens. I love this part of the movie. Okay. So who wins? Who wins, Wade?
Bourville.
Bourville wins.
It's Cuthbert. Where are
actually Bourville is actually funny at this part of the movie. He was annoyed me a lot before, but I thought he was really good here. Okay, Sir Cuthbert wins. He comes in first.
The bad guy wins.
Again, just like in the Great Race, we saw the bad guy win in the Great Race. But hey,
yeah,
we saw the rival good guy win in the Magnificent Men. But here, I should have mentioned when the French ladies drop out. That's just like in the Great Race and Magnificent Men, where someone heroically elects not to win the race.
Right. In both cases, it was the one thing I did like about that was in both cases it was the men who heroically elected not to win. In this case, it was the women. I thought that was
very
nice.
Chivalrous of them. Okay, so Sir Cuthbert wins, but he's got the jewels on him. Oh no, they saw where the jewels came from. So the Italians finger Sir Cuthbert and Perkins, and so they get arrested, which means he's disqualified from the race. So who came in second? Willie came in second. And he's so proud, he tears off his mustache and proclaims that he's Willie, the greatest driver. And like, oh, you escaped from prison. So you're arrested, and you can't win the race. So now who wins? The Italians win. But the Italians win. The Italians say, no, we really win for the French ladies because they were so heroic. So they really win. And so everybody gets to win. Even Chester, who, because Sir Cuddy's gone, if Chester just crosses the finish line, he beats Sir Cuddy and he gets the whole factory.
Right.
So he's still asleep. Right. They push him across the finish line. He wins the factory.
Everybody wins
except for Dawlish and Barrington.
Except for the British Empire.
Yeah, except for the British Empire. They blew up. I really loved that ending.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
And the pacing, it probably sounds stupid and tedious as I describe it, but the pacing of it is so fast and rapid fire, and it's like, it doesn't even give you time to think ahead, like, well, who's going to, wait, are they going to drop out too? Like, it doesn't give you that second to breathe. Like, it's just bang, 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 and you're distracted by the fact that every time they announce a winner, Bourville is presenting the trophy, and he pours the champagne in, but he drinks from the trophy first.
And now he's and then hands it to the
done
reason?
This so many times that he's become
he's
inebriated.
Hammered.
And there's quite a lot of good clowning by him in this scene. And that's it. Like, what's the final shot of the movie? I don't even remember.
The final shot actually has haunted me ever since. because after the movie, it goes into that kind of kaleidoscope montage of like they've got like five frames of film going, showing either scenes that already happened or actually scenes that they probably cut.
That half hour going. Missing footage.
Right.
I was really happy at those bits because I'm like, oh, that's how you condense this movie down. But maybe that was just for the American edit.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. The trailer is full of it if you watch the trailer. But it does that thing. But in the center, it's just this long shot of a scene. It is a scene of Chester and Betty. And they're talking to someone off screen, but you don't hear them. You just hear the music. Okay. And it's like a cut. It's literally a scene.
Yeah.
That they're just not hearing. And then right before it fades out, you see Tony Curtis go, "What? What? What?" And then it fades out. but fades out just like on a timer. Not to like make you wonder what it was, like just fades out because the music is ending. You know? Like that's the amount of time the music was, and that's the amount of footage we had. And we just let it run until it times out. Because I said why they did not cut the last shot in the movie before Tony Curtis had a startled reaction that we'll never know what it was for. I'll never know. Except for the thing that maybe they were trying to do a Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines thing where, you know, they were going to cut to that startled look to the future and then that they just never put that on the end.
They're going to have a Lamborghini drive by really fast.
It was just a deleted scene, I think, they put on the end, and it just happened to end with a, oh my God, what is that? And then it just fades out. No, you're not going to know, buddy. Go home. Get out of here.
Okay, I got to the plot. That took a little longer than I thought. Was that okay? Was that too fast?
Yeah, it's fine. 30 minutes. All right.
Okay. So what do you think of all this, Wade? What sticks with you?
I know. The ending, because I don't know what that was. The thing that sticks with me the most is in that curling hockey scene.
Yeah.
When Peter Cook's car and Gert Frobe's car get on a frozen lake and start going through a curling game and then a hockey game, the car hits one of those stuntmen.
Yes.
Really hard.
Yes.
And they
that did not look like it was on purpose.
Yeah. That they put that in the trailer, I noticed. and they says, "Oh, looks like we hit someone, sir." Nope, he hit us. As Peter Cook says. But yeah, that haunts me. That really was brutal.
Yeah, that was the end of the movie.
I'm curious to hear your take, because I didn't, because again, this movie isn't as, it's not trying to be inspirational. Like Magnificent Men. This one is really just wanting to be zany. And that seems to be its only agenda.
Right. I mean, like, if you think of, like, traditional characters that you root for in this movie, like Chester just being the free-spirited go-getter who believes in himself and is undaunted is easy to root for. Marcello and Angelo are, like, as the dreamers and kind of they're the low-status characters.
Horny dreamers, but dreamers nonetheless.
Well, you know, that's a kind of dreaming.
It's kind of
wet dreaming. It could be just simple stories built around them, except the movie kind of centers Chester more than anybody else.
Yeah,
he's the one who has the most of a plot line to the movie. His rivalry with Sir Cuthbert, Marcello and Angelo is just a bunch of kind of empty gags. I don't know. Yeah. But otherwise, it's not really a movie about anything in particular that I could identify. It's just, you know, it's a spoof. It's a gag.
They're just having a laugh. I mean, I was trying to because the movie begins in India. So, like, I kept thinking, that has so nothing to do with the rest of the movie that I'm going, oh, there's some point being made here, because there's all this laboriousness getting this letter that people are willing to lay down their lives to get this letter to Dawlish and Barrington. And then they just, and there's a thing, oh, great, we're going to enter a race. Woohoo. You know, I kept thinking you're going to start your movie that way. There's got to be some, you know, larger point you're making about, you know, British colonialism or the vapidity of the races like this. But no, not really. I don't think there was any point made about that stuff. It was just to be silly.
I think,
which is fine.
I mean, the point of Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines was these men and their flying machines were magnificent. I think that was like all that movie was trying to say. I think like that era of Empire is where Ken Anakin's heart is. And I think that intro is showing it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you nailed it when you said like this one is trying to be more modern, more with the times, but Ken Anakin is kind of posing at that.
Yeah.
He doesn't really know what he's saying about it.
His crew seems to be more in tune than he is in this regard, I think.
Yeah.
But like as far as like what we're actually shooting and how we're contextualizing it, yeah, he's kind of a poser in that regard. Like it's trendy to be like on women's lib, but does he really believe it? I don't think so.
No, I think this is a very shallow movie. You know,
this is
the one that should have had Benny Hill in it, because this movie was totally like a really good Benny Hill show.
Yeah, he would have been great in this one.
When the ladies get out and decide, oh, look at the water, we have to bathe. We must bathe like sirens and take our clothes off. and they're just like going to splash around, and one of them's going to be topless, but only shot from the back. That like, you know, like, ooh, and then the Italians drive up, ooh, look, ladies, but they're in their under things wet, you know, it doesn't have the same kind of, I don't know if this is the right word, but like the respectful eroticism of Blake Edwards shooting Natalie Wood, like, you know, like, you know, women swimming is attractive. It just is. Whereas this is like, girls, coochie, coochie, coo. I don't know.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just much more infantile about it.
Infantile was the perfect word of the male.
It wasn't about allure. It was like, I'd like to squeeze some of that with my between my fingers in a very, I don't know. How can I make this sound grosser? But it does feel kind of gross.
We're trying to make it sound gross because it felt gross. It felt infantile. It felt childish. It's sophomoric, I think, is a good word for it.
I mean, the fact that his reaction is, we should steal their clothes so that they stay naked.
Yeah, exactly. What I find fascinating, when I saw this movie before we did the episode of Magnificent Man, I had said, I think we should do these movies in the same episode because I think... I felt before you had posed your analysis, I felt the only way that it was going to be interesting at all was to show them in contrast to each other and compare and contrast because the first movie had things about it that, like, if you just wrote down principles that the movie took, I think I would just looking at those alone go, Magnificent Men would be the superior movie. It's aspirational. It cast everyone as their own nationality. It's got a civil liberties, women's rights kind of thing it's pushing. I mean, that's all great, but it's terribly unfunny. It doesn't seem to know how to be a movie in almost any regard other than just being bright and colorful and I guess well shot. Then you go to the second movie where they have no principles. They're just being silly, but yet they are also racist and sexist in a lot of ways, while only just giving mere lip service to women's lib and things like that. But yet it's a better film. It's weird.
Yeah, it's true.
Like just based on the fact that it knows what movies can do. Like it uses the tools of movies better than the first one. And yet, well, the first one seems to have its heart in a more comfortable place, albeit ultimately abandoning Pamela's storyline. The second movie is kind of uglier, but it actually knows how to be a movie. And I hate that trumps it in my mind. I'm deeply uncomfortable with that. But I have to say, it's a better movie. I'd watch that one again long before I watch. You have to pay me money to watch the other one. I'd watch it, but you have to pay me money.
So again, I mean, I think the first one had a problem where all the money, I'm guessing, was going into building those planes and then these flying sequences once the race starts. And there's just not much they can do. You know, they have to kill time until the race starts because they have to get a pad out that part, but there's no plot that can happen. They didn't structure the practice part of the movie well, which is like what dominates the whole thing. And then in this one, they do a really smart thing, I thought. I thought it was really effective, is you do put all your money into second unit location shooting, where you're rarely going to have your stars at the location, and instead spend that money on your cast and studio stuff and then just insert them with process shots. I thought it was perfectly fine that all the in-vehicle shots was all studio stuff with process shots. I thought that worked great, honestly. I thought it was a lot of fun watching Tony Curtis like hunch forward over the wheel, like just like doing race car motions with his hands. Right. Like he was really good at that and making it seem like he was really intent on running this race. I'm being alone, but I'm indefatigable until somebody drugs me and fatigues me.
And that didn't even slow down the movie. Like, they drugged him and it didn't slow down the movie very much. And then Peter Cook's got this wonderful detached austerity where he takes great offense at almost everything, but no change in his countenance in front of this process screen. And it's hilarious.
That's the other thing that keeps this movie going for me, is every single time you cut to Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, it works. Like, those guys, I could just watch.
We didn't talk about them much in this whole thing, but really, when it goes to them, there's not a dud scene or dud moment in any of their interactions.
Peter Cook is MVP of this movie, because
just
him leaning back, because he's always leaning back in this weird way, and steering the steering wheel too much, right? Like a little kid driving.
Yeah.
But not reacting to anything that's happening, or barely, he's so reserved in all of his reactions, and he believes in himself so strongly and is unfazed by every disappointment, which is continual. All of his stuff keeps going wrong, and he's has a like a flicker of disappointment, but he refuses to acknowledge that it's actually a setback, because, you know, the Lord is in favor of the British, of course. It works for me every single time.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, literally, they're the joy, the real joy of the movie.
It's such a simply drawn caricature, but it's so effective.
And it doesn't run out of steam. You'd think it would, especially because the car just eventually falls apart and they can't finish. And they're just like, oh, okay. Yeah.
They're like the Germans in Magnificent Men. Like, they believe in their superiority, but they're not also not looking down on anyone else. You know?
Right, right.
They just know, they just believe their methods will triumph, because they believe in their methods.
One of my favorite bits is when they're riding down the snowy hill, when they've got the tank treads on the Dawlish vehicle. And they're going down, and they cut to that model shot, which is a pretty good model shot, actually, of the car ramping over like a ridiculous high thing. And they're midair, and Art Barrington, Dudley Moore, is driving. And Peter Cook says, land the car there.
Yeah, that was a great bit.
It's a great bit, because it's like, yeah, I know people like that.
You wouldn't be referring to anyone I know, would you?
No, it's just the people I work with. It's one of the few times that Barrington has a little bit of doubt that he lets show in the Dawlish, going, Yeah, he's definitely MVP of that movie.
They're so fun. When I say put them down, put them down. Drop them. You know, they subvert the push the button backs gag.
Exactly.
He never says push the button.
Drop them. No.
Do it now. Go ahead. My favorite line of the whole movie maybe was... It's not set up. We're missing something. Like, it must be snowing, and Willie would be remarking at the beauty of the snow coming from the sky. That's the only thing I could think of that would motivate him to say, perhaps the good Lord is sending us a nice surprise from heaven. Because he just says that out of nowhere, but then a ski jumper lands on...
Oh, right.
And goes through the roof of his car. In a bit of ironic counterpoint... But Willie needs a reason to say such a line, even though it's funnier that he just says it out of nowhere.
Right.
But it's just such a stupid line. Perhaps the good Lord is sending us a nice surprise from heaven.
I mean, Gert Frobe, again, I don't know, which movie do you think he's funnier in? He's funny in this one. I think he's funny in this one.
He's funnier in Magnificent Men. Because
I agree. I think
because he actually has a character I can make sense of. There's no Willie is all over the place in this movie. Like, it's never really established what he is or what he wants very much.
Yeah,
we're told he's the best racer of the underground, of the underworld, but he's not a particularly good driver compared to anyone else in this movie, including
exactly.
The people who we've been told do not know how to drive.
explicitly. So we're told a bunch of stuff that has no bearing on anything, and so I don't know who he is. He's supposed to be quick-tempered and dangerous, but that only matters once when he challenges Dawlish to a fight and pushes his car. And then he's never like a dangerous person again. He's just a buffoon. I don't know.
Yeah.
He's fine. He's funny when he's trying not to poo. He keeps trying to use the bathroom, but there's always somebody in it singing about Piccadilly.
Isn't that always the way?
Like a child, is holding his hand over his butt to keep himself from pooing. He could be doing a pee-pee dance.
It could be.
But no, it's we are. Yeah.
He's holding his butt to say, I need to poop, everybody. Yeah. This is the I need to poop dance.
And I'm prepared to catch it if it starts to come out.
But he does have opportunities to show how much, I think, good actorly work he's doing. Which, again, made me sad. I remember watching the movie going, being sad in the close-ups going, I don't think I've ever heard his real voice because he's always dubbed.
In
the films that I see. I keep going, would he be that much funnier if I could hear his voice, you know?
The guy he's paired with, that Pierre Schmidt, is Otto, who really doesn't have much to do in this movie.
No.
But apparently that guy was known as a dubber. Like, he dubbed Marlon Brando for all of Marlon Brando's roles.
Oh, really?
In the German dub.
Yeah, nice.
Speaking of dubbing, I don't know if he dubbed. It would have been funny if he dubbed Gert Frobe too.
Exactly. Hey, at 9 minutes and 25 seconds into this movie, at least on the version we saw, hair in the gate. I love it.
I miss that.
Yeah. Also, another Mad World connection. Jimmy Durante sings the title song.
Didn't I have him in my two-timers club?
I don't think you did.
I meant to. I sure meant to.
Maybe not.
Forgive me. You're right. How did I leave him out? Well, I was like all excited to put him in. I meant to have him first.
Yeah. Just thinking about, as I said right before, I was kind of refreshing myself with trailers and scenes and stuff from the movie. And one of the trailers ends with just second unit shot of Tony Curtis's Roadster just whipping around coastal roads. And I was looking at it going, how devastatingly more exciting this is than Magnificent Myth. Like, just, wow, it's such a better idea to use cars for a race.
Keep your race on the ground. Those pit stops, because, you know?
Exactly.
Well, they all stop in the same lodge for the night. Like, the movie gets juiced at that moment. Like, you need them crossing paths like that.
Because, you know, you got Dawlish and Grobe and the Germans banging each other's car together on the ice. They're interacting. Yeah. You got, you know, the car running, then they can stop and save each other. They got the trapped in the snow. You've got the, you know, all this stuff where the drivers can actually interact whether they're moving or not. So much smarter than the alternative. Get your actors in the same place. I mean, I'm a big defender of Iron Man 2. I like Iron Man 2 quite a bit. It's flawed. It's overstuffed.
Yes.
But I love Iron Man 2. One of its biggest problems is that Mickey Rourke and Robert Downey Jr. really only have one real scene together. And it cooks, that scene in the prison cell. It's a great scene. And you're kind of like going, we need the villains and the bad, good heroes and the villains to be in the same room for more than that.
Hey, it worked for Star Trek II Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, that's true. They never were in the same room.
I was thinking about that today.
They never were, but they talked to each other. They were looking at each other through the comm screen,
True.
So they had that interaction quite a bit.
They FaceTime.
They did FaceTime. Exactly.
So in The Great Race, we had the Strange Bedfellows bit where all four heroes and villains were under the blanket
trying to stay warm, and we were speculating mm-hmm. about what was happening and what could have been happening or should have been happening under that blanket. Here we got some bed swapping, thanks to Sir Cuthbert switching everyone's shoes so nobody knows what room to return to, and everyone's getting into beds with the wrong people. And the light keeps going out because of a thunderstorm. That was a pretty, like, it just, like, right now we're just, like, doing a farce. I'm, like, I'm watching this, and, like, we're just watching a different kind of movie right now. But I'm fine with it. I mean, this is, you want these different teams crossing paths. You want these strange bedfellows moments. It didn't get as sexy as one might have wanted. It got borderline rapey.
Rapey.
Marcello just grabs, like, oh, I'm going to take this opportunity to grab a lady and throw her in a room.
And she says, no, you know, no, no. And then next thing, they're romantically
involved.
That could
have been. I mean, the way to do that is one of them accidentally, through the whole, thanks to the shenanigans, gets into bed with the other one without having meant to, but finding themselves in bed together, they'd realize that they like it. That would have been a lot more fun to watch develop.
That's too sexy. You know?
The light goes on from the lightning right then. They see, but then, like, they jump out, but then they get back in, you know. That could have been. Let's do it that way next time.
Yeah. You don't have to do this crazy shoe farce.
Well, that could be from the shoe farce. That's fine.
Yeah, totally.
Just, like, let it be consensual from the jump. You know?
Right. Exactly.
Speaking of Marcello, I forgot to mention honorary You Watched It Wrong two-timers club, because both Lando Buzanca, who plays Marcello, and Jack Hawkins, who plays Count Levinovich, both in Ben-Hur.
Really?
Yeah. Jack Hawkins is the...
Jack Hawkins.
Yeah. He's... Jack Hawkins is Jack Hawkins. Say no more. He's the guy in the ship, the captain of the galley that Ben-Hur befriends and then rescues after the big battle. And then Lando just says he's like... has no lines. He's just like a slave and the Jesus, like...
But yeah, passage. still in Ben-Hur. That's pretty impressive.
So they've graced our podcast before.
That's right. I love to see that stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else to say about this movie other than because it's just the recantation of gags, because that's all. And you know what? A lot of the gags are really good. I mean, they're entertaining.
Let me ask you about one. So getting back to the snowy section. So Dawlish has the Dawlish snow pushers, which are basically plows. Right. We call those plows.
he invented the plow.
He invented
in 1920.
He said they're snow pushers, and he's got two of them pointed at odd angles on these extending, what do you call it, like the crisscrossy things that go out.
Right, right.
There's something about the way that those look when they pop out that was just making me think, I mean, there's something about it that looks like a very British special effect to me, and I couldn't put my finger on it, but it was like the Life of Brian when the spaceship flies through, and it's like it was like a Terry Gilliam-ish kind of thing. Like, it just felt
like very flat.
Yeah, the way it was photographed was like this long lens kind of photography, and it almost seemed squished. I don't know if it was undercranked, but things were just moving a little too fast. It was just very cartoony physics being applied to this very real world thing that they actually built. I don't know. Like, what reaction did you have, or can you identify what I'm talking about? I rewatched it. I'm like, what is it? What is this reminding me of? And I couldn't put my finger on it.
Well, there were some. I mean, I took more note of the model shots of that car going through the snow. So things that I realized was like, oh, this is like Godzilla level technology, but like it actually looks pretty
good.
When
the ski lift lifts it up, that very much looks like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
This is from someone's train set. This isn't a movie effect.
But the shot of it driving around with its the things extended and they're wobbling in the air. You know. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't get that same sense like Terry Gilliam animation style stuff, but something
not
was
not Terry
very,
Gilliam animation, Terry Gilliam live action.
I mean, there was just something very handmade about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're going to approximate, but we can't actually build these things because they don't work. So we're gonna approximate it. Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't really that struck by it. I didn't watch that.
I just thought there was something about the way that those things looked that was just so innately funny to me. And I can't describe what it is. It's just the way they're springing around. I mean, they look completely useless. I don't know. Just the fact that somebody thought this was a good idea. But yeah. It was the cheapness of it, but I don't know. Like it didn't have to be as funny as it was, and yet somehow it was perfectly engineered to be the funniest it could have been.
Well, yeah. Well, I think that a bad idea actualized is inherently looks very funny. I would have to say it's lightning in a bottle. You know that. You know that wonderful GIF that went around that was video of that poor mascot who was in the giant inflatable basketball mascot who was in the like the giant inflatable purple pink dinosaur outfit with the chomping head and he's on rollerblades.
The
blades.
Raptors? The Toronto Raptors?
Yeah, the Raptors. He's supposed to come down the thing and then he falls several times when he gets up and he comes down onto the court and falls on his face and the whole suit deflates. It's perfect comedy, and I can't explain why. Just the chomping mouth, the tail flopping over perfectly, the inevitability of thinking whoever put this guy in a suit and in rollerblades on a basketball court, the fact that they didn't know it would end like this is hilarious. Like, this is inevitable. The inevitability of this tragedy. It's Wile E. Coyote. You're going to strap yourself to a rocket and you think that's not going to end horribly?
I'm watching it now. Okay.
You're watching it now? It is. It never fails to make me laugh.
Yeah, that's pretty spectacular flop.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's this, I'm rollerblading, the thing's chomping, and he's airborne for something, and then just full body belly buster onto the ground, and then a perfect tail.
He really splats
it's perfect.
There. Yeah.
And then the stillness of it.
Maybe it's as simple as, you know, like in the stupid bumblebee sketches from the 70s SNL, which are never funny, but they have the antenna things on the springs and just the way that those bob is
and they just move.
Kind of funny, and it just looks like those. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's all it is.
That's all it is. Something is, you're having some sort of associative trigger, I think. But yeah, just those things rolling around, they're just inherently, it's lightning in a bottle. It just happens to be comic perfection.
Well, speaking of perfection, We're saying we're done talking about this movie, and yet we're trying to stretch it out. Maybe we should have let our episode be short for once. And
I think so.
And just say, hey, you know, if you just want a really silly, brain dead time, you had just had a bad day, and you just need something diverting. I think you could do worse than throw $2.99 at Monte Carlo or bust.
Yeah, I sign off on that. It was a welcome. I still can't get over the fact that it's the same crew. I mean, the same director, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense. Other than the fact that he learned lessons. That's all he, or listened to people. Took constructive criticism, maybe. I don't know.
He grew as an artist. I'm not sure.
No, he abandoned the only few things that were good about his previous
film. I'm not sure there's a lot of artistry at work here, but the craft is improved. I'll say that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's wrap this up.
All right.
So going back in time once again, once upon a time, Wade and I, when we were first conceiving this miniseries and trying to figure out what are we even talking about? What movies are we going to include? Like what is the miniseries we're going to do? And it never crossed our mind until like the last minute to do these last three movies, because we didn't think they fit into what we originally saw as what this miniseries was about. So Magnificent Men, Great Race, Monte Carlo. We weren't going to do these three.
Yeah,
we were going to skip right over them, because the thread that we were really picking up on was not just that these were wacky races, but that these were outlaw races, right? That this going back to the Mad Men, going back to the It's a Mad, 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 Mad World thing, like these were races that weren't supposed to be happening.
They were unsanctioned, going under the social code, under the laws even.
Breaking the boundaries of society.
Right.
To do something you're not supposed to be doing. Naughty races. Not just wacky races, naughty races. Right?
Illegal races. Yeah. Right.
Rebellion. Yeah. And these last three movies have been not about that. They've been like, I, the owner of a newspaper, will announce this race that gentlemen will take part in.
Right.
Right? And everybody will be waiting at the finish line and there'll be a big hullabaloo. But we're getting past that now. So just as was well documented in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, we're about to enter the phase of outlaw cinema, right?
Right.
Bonnie and Clyde has already come out. Easy Rider is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like the product of Hollywood is going to be changing. So we're not just going to get movies about outlaws. It's going to be made an outlaw way. We're going to get back to what was happening. It's a mad world. These people were not supposed to be doing this race. They were breaking the law by not even
breaking the law.
Not saying they knew where Smiler had buried that money and trying to get it for themselves. These are people trying to change their status in society. They're not already on top. They're not some rich bloke using daddy's money to enter this race. These are the outsiders, right?
They're not people who can walk into any newspaper and say, let's sponsor an international race.
Yeah.
Not these
this
guys.
Now we're getting into getting us excited about this whole idea about these movies and what we really thought appealed to us about them. And so for our next entry, we're going to zoom ahead to 1975 for a very non-studio picture. Roger Corman, the outlaw filmmaker extraordinaire, with a little movie called Death Race 2000. Ooh, doesn't it sound dangerous?
Yeah.
That's a race that shouldn't be happening, right?
But it's still kind of like organized and kind of sanctioned and kind of unsanctioned. You know, it's a little weird gray area. Nice transition between what we've seen before and now what we're going into.
But just
now,
the fact of you watching Death Race 2000, isn't that an act of rebellion in itself?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we hope you'll rebel with us. And join us for that next episode. But until then, let us know what you've thought about these square entries by all these stuffed shirts in their wacky races and where you think this mini-series should be going. You can send us a tweet. Our Twitter feed is you, with the letter U, watched it wrong on Twitter. We also have a Facebook page. You can find us there. Or email us, which is what we like most of all, at youwatchedwrong, all spelled out one word, at happypanic.net. You can also follow our profiles on Letterboxd, where I am SIGGYLLAMA. He is Carney of Steel, like the alloy. And until then, if you thought Terry Thomas blowing up the last fuel depot before you cross the mountain would cause other drivers to have a shortage of fuel, you watched it wrong.